Good morning. I'm Susan Zesch, Director of the Human Rights Program here at the University of Chicago, and I'm very pleased to welcome all of you to the panel day of our conference, Genocide, Crimes Unpunished, Lessons Unlearned. This conference is brought to you by the hard work of the Coordinating Committee and the advice of the faculty advisors, whose names you see in your program. In particular, I would like to thank Babafemia Kinranati, who will speak after me, who has been the postdoctoral instructor in the Human Rights Program the last 2 years, and is really the intellectual author of the concept of this conference and its panels. The development of the conference was done by committee, however, and we had a lot of student involvement and a lot of discussion back and forth about how we would present this important topic to you today. As I stated last night, this year is the 60th anniversary of the Genocide Convention, and genocide still exists in the world today. That's the problem we have to confront. We will now hear a couple of words from Babafemia Kinranati and then Aliza Levine representing STAND.
Thank you. My name is Babafemia Kinranati, and I'm an instructor in the Human Rights Program. As Susan has said, this conference is born out of many factors. The first is the 60th anniversary of the Genocide Convention, and the more immediate reason is was the campaign on this campus for divestment by students, a request by the students for the university to divest from Sudan. And it went a very long way, and the result and the consequence is the setup by the university of an action and education fund, which was possibly a better alternative to divestment. So here we are, and I welcome everybody to this conference, and the STAND representative also will speak about that, and so let me give her the microphone.
Thank you, Babafemi. I just wanted to speak briefly, as Babafemi said, about the history of student activism that, along with the dedicated members of the Human Rights Department, brought about this conference. 2 years ago, students at this university formed a chapter of STAND, a Student Anti-Genocide Coalition, to discuss with university administrators the possibility of divesting their holdings from companies doing business in the Sudan, and especially with the Sudanese government, which funds the ongoing genocide. And a year ago, after vocal student support, many conversations, the university rejected the offer of divestment, becoming the first university in the nation to do so, and instead formed an action and education fund for Darfur, which is one of the sources of funding for this conference. As the students who are working on this, we rejected the fund as an alternative to divestment and are still asking for divestment today, but are really grateful that the fund has been able to support important projects such as this one going on today and other valuable projects. So with that, I just want to thank the Human Rights Department for making this a really successful locus of both education and activism.
Just a few sort of housekeeping matters. If you did not sign up on the tables or register, double check your registration when you came in, we'd appreciate your doing that sometime during the day. One of the missions of the Human Rights Program is to connect theory and practice and connect scholarship with activism. So we have not only panels of very distinguished activists and scholars today, we're very pleased and grateful that our panelists have traveled so far, many of them to be with us and look forward to their remarks, but we also have invited organizations in the city who are active in the issues that you will be hearing about today to set up tables at the back of the room so that when you are inspired by what you hear, we also have made it very easy for you to figure out what to do. So without further ado, I would like to introduce and thank Holly Schisler, who will be the moderator of our first panel. Holly herself is a professor in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations and is also director of the University Center for Middle East Studies. She will introduce our panel. Thank you.
Good Good morning, and first of all, I want to thank the Human Rights Program for inviting me to participate in this panel and in this and for organizing this fantastic and I think very important event. Can you hear me all right? Am I speaking into the microphone? Okay. As you know from the program, but I will briefly recap and say that the first panel is called "Defining the Crime Without a Name," and we have three very distinguished speakers who will address that theme this morning. The first is Marie Fleming, professor of the Department of Philosophy at Florida State University. The second is Juan E. Mendez, president of the International Center for Transitional Justice in New York, and the former special advisor to the UN Secretary General on the Prevention of Genocide. And the third is Irvin Staub, Director Emeritus, Psychology of Peace and the Prevention of Violence in the Department of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. The speakers will present in that order, and we will hold questions, please, until all three people have had a chance to make their presentations, at which point there'll be an opportunity to ask questions and engage in dialogue. So, as I say, our first speaker will be Professor Fleming, and her paper or her presentation is entitled "Defining Genocide: Issues of Motive and Intent."
Today, my presentation will be—I will just sort of talk about it in three sections. First, I'll talk about crime without a name and refer to the historical context. Second, I'll talk about genocide and mass murder, and with reference to how to define genocide. And then I'll talk about motive and intent, and that will also be coming through in the other two sections. And particularly the problem of how to distinguish genocide from mass murder by reference to motive and intent. Okay, crime without a name. The phrase "crime without a name" was used by Winston Churchill in a radio broadcast on August the 24th, 1941. He spoke of the most frightful cruelties of the Nazi troops, their methodical, merciless butchery, in his words. Whole districts are being exterminated, these are his words, with scores of thousands of executions in cold blood. Now, we do not know what Churchill meant when he said, in the dramatic statement that's often quoted, "We are in the presence of a crime without a name," unquote. According to Churchill's biographer, the Prime Minister was reacting to the first phase of the Holocaust. But Churchill referred specifically in this context to Nazi atrocities on the Soviet front line and made no mention of the Jews. In fact, not only did the broadcast say nothing about the Jews, but as historians tell us, Churchill did not receive information about the mass execution of Jews until after August 24th, i.e. after the radio broadcast. Historians want to pin down what Churchill knew and what he was thinking about. I know a few historians very closely. But in their meticulous labors at settling the record, they can miss important connections. Churchill's concern was the attempt by the Nazis to force through what he called a new order, in the first instance on Europe and then on the rest of the world. It was the rule of the Herrenvolk, he said, the master race. Hitler's was not just another murderous and ambitious regime. The Hitler phenomenon was historically unprecedented. It sought to establish a hierarchical system of nations with the dream of having his people, his folk, occupy the space of the dominant racial group. More is involved here than a war against racial or ethnic groups. What is fundamental to Nazism and like ideologies is the denial of the right to existence of such groups, culturally and physically. As the jurist Raphael Lemkin was to plead to the UN and to all and anyone who would listen to him. By 1941, Lemkin had already spent some two decades advocating for victims of murderous regimes. Determined to find a name for precisely what he believed the British Prime Minister was talking about, he went on in his 1944 book to call the crime genocide. The term is coined from the Greek word for race and the word from Latin, the latter part from the Latin meaning to kill. Genocide, literally to kill a race. It appeared in the indictment at the Nuremberg trials of 1945-46, though it was not listed among the charges, nor to Lemkin's disappointment did the word appear in the Nuremberg judgments. But the world started to take note. On December 11, 1946, the UN Assembly passed a unanimous resolution condemning genocide as, in quotes, the denial of the right of existence of entire human groups. This resolution and the UN's announcement of plans for a law to make genocide an international crime was called a revolutionary development by the New York Times. There were intense negotiations, and genocide was recognized as a crime by the 1948 Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. It took, sadly, half a century before anyone was actually convicted of the crime. From the beginning, there has been considerable difficulty in arriving at anything like consistency on the question of how to define genocide, whether as an analytic term for research purposes or as a legal term for purposes of identifying the crime. These areas of concern overlap, of course. Understanding what kind of crime genocide is has significance, not just for legal specialists, but also for scholars in the field. The problem of definition reaches an impasse on two contradictory views. One, that genocide is a new crime connected to modernity, and two, that genocide is a form of atrocity that has occurred throughout human history. The latter view results in a nullification of the need for a name over and beyond mass murder. If genocide has taken place as long as humans have been around, it will keep on recurring, and short of an inconceivably fundamental transformation of the human species, there is no need and no reason to think we can do much about it. Prevention is next to impossible, theoretically and practically. The question of how to define the crime emerges in Churchill's speech, but it is not settled with Lemkin's argument for calling it genocide. That is to say, the problem of definition, whether genocide is something new or whether it is a recurring feature of human societies, has its origins in Lemkin's own thinking, and specifically in his failure and in that of the UN Convention to come to terms with the distinction between motive and intent. We have a situation, I argue, whereby genocide cannot be defined without reference to motive, and yet, even when one acknowledges that this factor separates genocide from mass murder, motive is put to one side, even reduced to intent. Now, the second section on genocide and mass murder. The whole point of Lemkin's naming of genocide was to distinguish it from mass murder, to mark it as a different crime. Mass murder aims at the physical destruction of individuals who may or may not represent a national group, and encompasses a range of intentions and motivations that may or may not be related to the ethnicity or religion of the victims. The perpetrator may, for example, covet the land of a group that also is or happens to be of a particular ethnicity or religion. What distinguishes genocide from mass murder is the motive. Lemkin's claim, this is in a very short article, a four-page article written in 1946, is that genocide, in contrast to mass murder, here he's attempting to define it in contrast to mass murder, encompasses the biological and cultural annihilation of a national or ethnic group as an entity, his words, as an entity. The as an entity, the motivating factor, is crucial to the definition of genocide. The phrase indicates that for an aggressor group, a particular nation or race or ethnic group has become identified as one that ought not to exist, culturally and even biologically. The nation or racial group's very existence becomes intolerable for the aggressor, is perceived as an affront that the aggressor seeks to eliminate. The genocide precedes, Glemkin writes in, this is in the 1946 article, it proceeds by means of a coordinated plan of different actions to dismantle the political and social institutions supporting the culture, language, national identity, religion, and livelihood of the targeted group. The objective is to destroy the personal security of the individuals belonging to the group, their liberty, health, dignity, even their lives. The actions are directed, he emphasized, against individuals, but not against individuals in their capacity as individuals, rather as members of a national or racial or religious group. The innocence of a child, for example, leaves the aggressor unmoved because the child's existence is the group's existence. Lemkin saw rightly that genocide was a new and threatening phenomenon. The perpetrator aims at the destruction of the group as an entity, independently of any instrumental or material benefits that might also thereby be gained. And the action is directed against individuals as members of the targeted group. However, Lemkin also made statements in the very same short article that undermined his own insights and that did not distinguish clearly between genocide and mass murder, even though his aim was to distinguish genocide from mass murder. He went so far as to say that the German case was the most striking of several examples that could be found in past centuries. He referred to the destruction of Carthage, 146 BCE, the fate of religious groups in the Wars of Islam and the Crusades, the massacres of religious dissidents in the medieval times. Hence, it was Lemkin, the person who named the new crime, who also, and even in the same breath as it were, suggested that genocide is not really a new crime after all, that genocidal acts against helpless populations have been going on for many centuries, thousands of years. Now, how to explain Lemkin's contradictory statements and in the space of his four-page article at a time, 1946, when he was campaigning for international recognition of the crime of genocide as a new crime. And this takes me to the topic of motive and intent in criminal law. Lemkin was part of a jurist, part of the legal profession, and working within the parameters of the classical understanding of criminal law. The law, I capitalize law of the law, is a procedure for determining criminal intent with a view to establishing guilt, with minimal, if any, attention to motive. As regards motive and intent, the UN Convention operates much the same as criminal law in general. Lemkin fought hard to get the crime of genocide recognized. He sensed that motive was the key to understanding genocide. But he thought, apparently, that motives were irrelevant in determining the guilt of those who committed genocide. Now, moving on to motive and intent. Intent refers to the mental state of the perpetrator, the mens rea or guilty mind. Did the person knowingly, purposefully carry out the act? Actus reus, the guilty act. Did the person intend to kill? Motive is the cause that moves the person to undertake the action. Someone might have a motive, but might decide not to undertake the action. So motive is independent of intent. Formally, motive can be offered in a trial, in a normal, average criminal trial, to make it more plausible why someone would or would not have committed a crime. We always want to know what the motive is, or would somebody have had a motive. But nevertheless, legally, motive remains background information. Motive is not required and classically understood as having no bearing on the determination of guilt. Motive frequently plays a role at the sentencing stage to determine whether or not there were aggravating or mitigating circumstances, and with a view to influencing punishment. The person is convicted of committing a guilty act, but how bad was the motive? Was it for personal gain? Did someone do a bad thing but have an, in quotes, good motive, mercy killing? On the pattern of criminal law in general, the convention does not require a genocidal motive, or any motive for that matter. As I indicated just earlier, motive is raised in Lemkin's reference to the destruction of a nation or ethnic group as an entity. And traces of motive linger in the UN definition of genocide, in their reference to, in quotes, the intentional destruction in whole or in part of a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such, unquote. So the as such seems to recall the as an entity, so it's still there somewhat. However, even though the as such appears in the convention, motive is not a legal component of the guilt of genocide. As Ben Kiernan, in his new book, explains, motive is absent from the UN Convention. This absence is intentional. In the negotiations leading up to the adoption of the convention, a motive requirement had been proposed. Under that proposal, genocide would have been defined as a crime committed on the grounds of, in quotes, or because of the national identity, race, religious belief, or political opinion of the members of the group. However, during the negotiations, that requirement was eliminated from the convention's text. To reassure those people who are worried about the efficacy of the law in relation to prosecuting genocide, a concession was made whereby the text now referred to as I just quoted, the intentional destruction of the group as such. Now, while the as such suggests something akin to a motive, in terms of a strict reading of the convention, the reference is, as Kiernan says, legally meaningless. The convention requires only that the genocide be the outcome of an act in question. There is no requirement that the perpetrator be motivated by genocide. The specific intent that's required to destroy a group becomes a matter of judging intentional and purposive action, as is the normal practice in criminal law. And a 1998 judgment of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda put it, in quotes, the perpetrator clearly seeks to produce the act charge. It's the intent. Now, as for proof of genocidal intent, of course, this might be gleaned from expressions of intentions or established by examining the actions of the perpetrator. Now, Kiernan is not at all unhappy with this result. And he's quick to proclaim that, in his words, the more colloquial understanding that the crime requires a genocidal motive from the start has no legal basis, unquote. He affirms the openness of the definition of genocide as a way of adding to the list of possible motives that over the centuries led to the suffering and destruction of so many different groups. Genocide, in his view, can encompass atrocities based on any number of motives. And he mentions conquest, national security, ethnic cleansing, communism. Proceeding, as Kiernan does, from a narrow reading of the convention, there is no requirement to raise the issue of motive that that seems to touch on the core problem of genocide and what distinguishes it from mass murder. And if motive does come into play, it has no legal standing in determining guilt. In his view, Kiernan's view, genocide is not necessarily the motive of those who commit genocide. The motive, he says, in his words, could be a consciously accepted consequence of such acts perpetrated in the service of a variety of motives or goals, unquote. However, in this particular case then, a genocidal motive would be secondary to other motives if it was accepted as a consequence rather as the substantial motive. If the intent to destroy a nation or ethnic religious group becomes a defining characteristic of genocide rather than motive, the definition of genocide is virtually guaranteed to slide into an endless list of historical and contemporary examples of mass killings. Now, can this problem be fixed? What should we do about it? Well, the Kiernan approach is to accept the UN definition and a particular textbook view of criminal law as carved in stone. Another approach, mine, is to reject Kiernan's dismissal of the colloquial understanding of genocide and to suggest that the UN definition, after 60 years, needs revisiting. Relevant to my efforts are also current debates in US criminal law, claims about the importance of motive in criminal justice, and arguments for more explicit theorizing about motive. And some of these debates, of course, touch on and are an issue from questions about hate crimes. However, while we can draw on these debates to gain clarification on important questions, for the international crime of genocide, the motive intent issue becomes much more complex. So, how could we reconstruct the problem of defining genocide by distinguishing motive and intent? At what point would motive enter international criminal proceedings? On the model of criminal law generally, if we just look at criminal law generally, a crime has been committed, a person has been charged with a crime, guilt is determined on the basis of intent, and it is after this determination, i.e. after establishing guilt, that the sentencing stage begins. Motive enters in the second stage. But let's suppose it's true that motive is a contentious issue, and I won't go into the many complex questions that are raised, but let's suppose that motive is, while complex, that it can be determined in a manner that's not substantially more difficult than establishing intent. In debates in criminal law, concern is expressed for or against the principle of considering motive, but not the sentencing stage where motive enters. So a lot of these debates in, say, U.S. criminal law, they're discuss the importance of motive and want to make motive more explicit, but they don't question the fact that it comes in at the second stage, the sentencing stage. So you have the stage of criminal liability where guilt is established, and then you have the sentencing stage where punishment is established. So, but this motive still remains firmly, even in the context of the debates, more or less firmly, except for in one or two cases, at the sentencing stage. If genocide is defined in terms of motive as well as intent, the question of motive for genocide would have to enter the proceedings at the very beginning. It wouldn't be able, you're already talking about genocide, a genocidal motive at the beginning. The person would be charged with having a genocidal motive as well as a genocidal intent. Determining intent is not unproblematic, and sometimes it becomes extremely difficult. Motive would be assessed, like intent, by reference to the expressed opinions or determined on the basis of actions. Now, one objection to this, very briefly, I'm coming to a conclusion here, now that I have my moderator, many people would say, well, people have mixed motives. There are a lot of different motives. There may be a number of contributing factors that moved a person to act. This is the case with genocide, no less than with other crimes. And we could point to instances in criminal law in the US, for example, where courts have been guided by the doctrine of the substantial motivating factor test. In the case of genocide, there could be many motives, mixed motives, but what would need to be proved is that a genocidal motive was a substantial factor. It wouldn't mean to rule out other possible motives that the person might have. Now, my remarks today are an attempt to think through the crime without a name, beyond what Lemkin and others were able to achieve at a particular time in history, 60 years ago. They are a challenge to those of us today who do not see the need for rethinking the 1948 definition, and especially those of my colleagues who apparently see advantages in the retention of its present form. What are the consequences of not taking motive into account in defining genocide? We risk remaining as before, as Churchill said, in the presence of a crime without a name.
And the next speaker will be Juan Mendez, whose talk is entitled Obligations to Prevent and Punish in the Genocide Convention.
Thank you very much, and thank all of you for being here. But I especially want to thank the organizers for inviting me to come back to the University of Chicago for this very important conference. I also appreciate being put in the same panel with Professor Staub and Professor Fleming. It's a very important challenge to follow in their steps, but I really think that Professor Fleming has really set up the discussion very well for me to follow through, because I'm going to try to exemplify with my experience a little bit of why definitional problems in the Genocide Convention are important and why they present a challenge for implementing the convention 60 years after its adoption. I think we all realize that the Genocide Convention is precisely called a convention to prevent and to punish the crime of genocide. And so you would think that the convention tries to do both. And in a sense, it tries to do both by doing only one. The whole logic of the convention is mostly to prevent by punishing. And in that, it doesn't really succeed. And I think experience shows us that it's not going to be enough to punish. But of course, it's not the fault of the convention, because in addition, in 60 years, we have done little to punish even, let alone to prevent. And so we have a convention and we have to work with it, but we have to be self-conscious of its limitations. I am going to try to expand on why accountability for crimes that have already been committed is an essential ingredient on any policy of prevention that has a chance of success. The problems of the definition itself have already been explained by Professor Fleming, but I think in addition to having a definition that hampers our ability to deal with it, we also have in the convention a lack of implementation mechanisms that is also worrisome. The convention talks about universal jurisdiction but doesn't create any obligation on the signatory parties to establish any form of jurisdiction, let alone a universal jurisdiction. In essence, I want to preface what I'm going to read by exemplifying with this. I mean, in my experience as the special advisor on the prevention of genocide, I was asked many times why was I not deciding whether something amounted to genocide or not? And in fact, I was specifically mandated not to do that, but to act on prevention. That meaning that you know, if you're really going to have any chance to prevent something from happening, you really cannot wait until all the elements of the definition are in place. And yet, as the Darfur example shows, we have spent endless amounts of discussion going around deciding whether something is or is not genocide, when we have very full agreement that that certainly the events of 2003 were at least clearly war crimes or crimes against humanity, and we let the discussion about whether they also constituted genocide become a substitute for action. And because we need to act to prevent, it's important that we act before we can determine whether the definition itself has been triggered. And that obligation to act before is triggered not by whether something amounts to genocide or not, because the crimes against humanity and war crimes as categories are both morally and legally bind us all in the international community to act on them before they get out of hand. And so one of the most disappointing aspects of my tenure as special advisor to the on the prevention of genocide was precisely this sense that we were, you know, spinning our wheels deciding whether something was genocide or not, when we had the moral obligation and the legal and political obligation to act, whatever the label that we put on them. I believe very strongly that violence and mass atrocities cannot be effectively addressed without a serious attempt to break the cycle of impunity for human rights violations, especially if they are so widespread or systematic as to constitute war crimes or crimes against humanity. We also hold that accountability for such crimes must be comprehensive, balanced, and holistic, meaning that policies and practice must address the need to discover and disclose the truth, to bring perpetrators to justice, to offer reparations to the victims, and to promote deep reforms in the institutions through which state power is exercised. While criminal prosecution should not be the sole response to impunity, there is no doubt that they must play a central, indispensable role in any policy of accountability. At the same time, we at the ICTJ insist that domestic prosecutions represent the state's fundamental obligation to give access, to give victims access to justice. On the one hand, the international community must pay more attention to helping states live up to this obligation by building independent, impartial judiciaries that can prosecute mass atrocities with full respect for due process of law and fair trial. On the other, our support of the role of the International Criminal Court and other international criminal justice ventures must be oriented towards supplementing the absence of will or capacity to produce fair trials domestically, but also to help generate that capacity in the near future. Breaking the cycle of impunity and fostering accountability is a crucial component in the prevention of future violence and mass atrocities. No prevention efforts can take place without a serious attempt to break the cycle of impunity for past human rights violations, especially if they are so widespread or systematic as to constitute war crimes, crimes against humanity, or genocide. If perpetrators feel shielded from prosecution or investigation for the crimes they have already committed, they will have an incentive not only to commit them anew, but also to raise the stakes and perpetrate even more serious crimes. The failure to do justice to the victims usually leads to sentiments of revenge, and thus to the likelihood of more crimes. Accountability is essential to halt the vicious cycle of revenge, but also to enable the victims to make their own decisions as to their protection and well-being, so that they're not merely passive recipients of the international community's efforts. Finally, accountability for past crimes is also important so that the victims, their families, and communities can distinguish between their victimizers and the communities that those victimizers claim to represent, so that the blame for the atrocities is not visited generations down the road on innocent descendants of those perpetrators. It must be understood, however, that prevention of genocide will require more and different measures. Bringing the perpetrators to justice will not be enough. Prevention of genocide will require early warning and reasonable suggestions for early action. The office I held for 30 months at the request of Secretary General Kofi Annan was the first attempt by the United Nations to apply lessons learned and correct the structural weaknesses that caused the UN to fail to prevent genocide in Rwanda and in Srebrenica in the 1990s. As a very preliminary observation, my experience demonstrates that early warning and early action can serve important purposes. Still, the bottleneck is the political will to act that is almost never present from the start. In that sense, the role of the Special Advisor is, I think, primarily directed to contribute to shape and create that political will, in conjunction with public opinion, with caring institutions, and with willing democratic states. In terms of proposals for early action, in the application of the mandate to the situation in Darfur, I learned early on that the international community needed to act comprehensively and simultaneously on four fronts. The first is protection of civilians and persons who are at risk, including by armed contingents if necessary. The second is the effective delivery of humanitarian assistance to reverse the effects of what already has happened to them, but also to give them some empowerment. The third is the resolution of the underlying conflict through a vigorous peace process. And the fourth is the accountability for the war crimes and crimes against humanity that have already been committed. Specific measures have to be adopted and implemented in each of the four areas in a coordinated fashion, but it's very important that we don't allow progress in each of those four areas to be contingent on achievements on any other. In Darfur, instead, the regime has succeeded in blocking serious action by creating a vicious cycle by which each measure has to wait until another measure has been negotiated. Needless to say, I continue to hold that effective prevention requires a concerted attempt to break the cycle of impunity. The situation in Uganda has revived a debate as to whether the interest of peace should always trump justice demands, a debate which some of us had hoped was more settled by now. To those of us who have followed the evolution of human rights in the last 25 years, the debate rings of earlier discussions as to whether fragile democracies could really afford to investigate and disclose, let alone prosecute, the major crimes of the preceding era. Always implicitly, but on a couple of occasions very explicitly, the citizens of those young democracies were asked to choose between justice and democracy, or between justice and the rule of law, to paraphrase a famous threat by Augusto Pinochet, because it could not have both. The creation of the International Criminal Court in 1998 was a high point of an evolution in policy and practice, accompanied by emerging norms in international law, signaling that accountability for war crimes and crimes against humanity was from now on paramount, and that the international community would not countenance impunity for such atrocities. But the Rome Statute was not only the culmination of a clear trend that had started in the early 80s in the context of transitions to democracy. It was also the means to establish an instrument that made justice possible even when the national state was unable or unwilling to afford it. And yet, for each situation in which the ICC has acquired jurisdiction, we hear voices calling for amnesty, withdrawal of indictments, or other forms of exercising discretion and avoid prosecutions, supposedly in the name of peace. As in the 1980s, with the best of intentions, some are urging measures that implicitly give in to the blackmail of the parties to the armed conflict. And that blackmail is, peace can only come if those accused of atrocities are given guarantees that they will not be touched. In northern Uganda, there is a broad recognition that the ICC indictments have assisted in bringing the LRA to the negotiating table. But now, some portray those indictments as obstacles to progressing further with the peace process. There are calls for the prosecutor to exercise his discretion and suspend investigations and withdraw the indictments. There's also, some have suggested that the Security Council should intervene and suspend investigations, as it is possible to do under the Rome Statute. not denying, of course, that that is a possibility, I think it would be an unwarranted interference by a political organ with the independence and impartiality of a judicial organ. In any event, in the case of Uganda, these proposals are all premature and misdirected. The parties to the peace process have the burden of showing that the ICC is no longer needed, a burden of which they are well aware and that they have not met. If an alternative to criminal justice in the form of traditional justice, with an element of truth-seeking and reparations, can be achieved in Uganda, as in the form of Mato or Put, it will be for the ICC judges to evaluate whether those procedures are sufficient under Article 17 of the Rome Statute to cause the arrest warrants to be withdrawn. I can also offer other examples of how the implied threat of an ICC prosecution has had beneficial impact on the ground. In Colombia, the law on demobilization of the paramilitary groups would have been much worse than it is in the sense of promoting impunity if it were not for the need to offer a semblance of compliance with the international standards set forth in the Rome Statute. In fact, the Constitutional Court amended and corrected many of the more outrageous elements of that law, precisely invoking obligations of the Colombian state under the Rome Statute and under other international human rights treaties. In Cote d'Ivoire, the prospect of prosecuting those who used hate speech to instigate and incite to commit crimes under the ICC jurisdiction kept those actors under some level of control. Obviously, wrongdoers on the ground quickly adjust to shifting situations, so in the future it will not be enough simply to invoke the threat of prosecutions. More will be needed, and more will also be needed in terms of international cooperation, thank you, with the ICC. More stark are some of the lessons we are learning on state cooperation in terms of securing arrests. This general lack of cooperation does not affect only the ICC, but also to worrisome extent the other international criminal courts. New approaches will have to be explored as state parties learn to accept responsibility under the Rome Statute. In Darfur, the ICC faces challenges of a different nature. In my role as special advisor, I visited Darfur in 2004 and 2005 and was able to see how impunity for the massacres of 2003 that exacted the cost of 200,000 lives was in itself a factor of instability and a hindrance to prevention of future cases. That is why very early on I joined those who called for a referral of the case to the ICC by the Security Council, a measure of historic significance that was adopted almost exactly 3 years ago in 2005. But 3 years since that decision, and the Khartoum regime has repeatedly stated that it does not recognize it and that it will not cooperate with the Office of the Prosecutors or with the arrest warrants against Ali Kushaib and Ahmad Haroun. In that long period, the Security Council made no effort to remind the government of Sudan that this was a decision adopted under Chapter 7 of the Charter and therefore binding on all states. Instead, we have let the regime get away with the defiance of a resolution adopted in furtherance of international peace and security. Even if the Security Council was unwilling to address its failure to cooperate, it should have been incumbent on other important international actors, particularly member states interested in Darfur and in the ICC, to press Khartoum on this issue. It would also have been important for the mission on the ground of the United Nations and for high-ranking officials in the United Nations Secretariat to include this agenda item in the relations with Khartoum. As far as I can see, only the High Commissioner for Human Rights and my Office of Prevention of Genocide raised this important point from time to time. The result is not only that we do not offer the ICC and the Office of the Prosecutor the support that they need. It is also that we have given away cards that we could have used in negotiating with Khartoum to better protect and assist the more than 3 million Darfuris who are now totally dependent on international assistance. It is unfortunately not the only mistake that the international community has made along this path that has rendered it all too weak and has strengthened the hand of the regime responsible for the 2003 massacres in Darfur. But lack of follow-up on the referral to the ICC certainly contributes to our seeming inability to stem the downward spiral into more violence in that region. I know that I'm running out of time, so I just want to end with a reference to the other international and hybrid criminal tribunals that have been created since the early 90s. They represented an important landmark in the international community's commitment to accountability for major crimes. They also paved the way for the creation of the ICC as a permanent court by demonstrating that prosecutions by international courts were possible and that they were possible with a rigorous respect for fair trial guarantees. Those courts have offered significant precedents and have advanced our understanding of fundamental human rights standards with their landmark decisions. Like the International Criminal Court, their role in punishment has also played an important preventive function. Now, however, these courts are being prompted to develop a completion, quote-unquote, strategy that places great pressure on them to offer plea bargains and to drop prosecutions for lack of time. Even more ominously, there is great uncertainty as to what the international community is prepared to do to ensure that the legacy of these courts is assured and preserved for the future. But I do not want to end on a pessimistic note. In fact, we should just look back to less than 15 years ago and see how far we have come from the pervasiveness of impunity for grave human rights crimes and from the permissive attitude towards that impunity by the international community. Of course, much more needs to happen in terms of judicial response to mass atrocities and to prevention, but I think you will agree with me that we are on the right track. Thank you.
Good morning. It's wonderful to follow two such excellent talks, and it's good to be here with you. You will see, could you turn? I have an overhead. I have a PowerPoint, which I'm always very conflicted about, because you will read what is there rather than listen to me. But last time I get my audience to take a vote, and they voted to have the PowerPoint on. So if the PowerPoint happens, I am going to talk about prevention primarily, but you cannot talk about prevention without also talking about the origins of violence between groups. I make a distinction between halting violence and genuine early prevention. Now, by halting violence, I don't mean, let's go on a couple forward. By halting violence, I don't mean halting genocide, but halting significant violence already. As we know, we don't even halt genocide. It's very difficult to stop genocide when it is already ongoing. The international community is very slow. We don't have the systems. In order to truly prevent genocide, we have to act early. We can predict the probability of group violence. We know enough now to identify the conditions that make violence by groups of a significant kind, by other groups, highly probable. However, we don't know the exact form that violence will take, because as you will see from later what I am saying, and as you know already, genocide evolves. It doesn't just spring up like that. And it could be that what we have to predict the violence that may be forthcoming is going to lead to mass killing. It could be that it would lead to some killing of a particular group, the purpose of which is not to eliminate the group, but in order to intimidate the group. Now, I always wondered in the Genocide Convention, what does in part mean? So that early action is extremely important, and we cannot wait until we know that this may be a genocide that is developing. We have learned that once violence has taken place, in order to make it less likely that there will be a continued cycle of violence, reconciliation is crucial. Now, as I think about it, reconciliation is very important, not only after violence, but before significant violence between hostile groups, because reconciliation involves processes that lead to greater mutual acceptance by groups of each other, the processes and the institutions involved in that. So we must be thinking about prevention and reconciliation together. I'm I have developed over the years a conception of how genocide originates, but also in relation to that, what we need to do to prevent violence between groups. And there are certain starting points, instigating conditions. No element creates genocide, but each of them makes it a little bit more likely and contributes to processes that create a system that leads to the evolution of violence. Some of these starting points are very difficult conditions of life in a society. Economic deterioration. Poverty is not an important condition, but deterioration is. Political disorganization. Very great social change. Conflict between groups that goes on for a significant length of time and it is persistent. So there are these conditions in the world, and they have powerful psychological effects on whole groups of people. What are some of these effects? One of them is that a person who may have felt like an individual going about their own life, living with their family, because of the uncertainty and difficulty, shifts identity to a group. Well, why is that? Another condition is that people begin to scapegoat. Members of groups begin to scapegoat other groups. We are not at fault, they are at fault. And the third crucial condition is that almost always a destructive ideology is created. What do I mean by destructive ideology? In difficult conditions, people need a vision of something more positive, of something hopeful for them. Unfortunately, the visions that they create under these conditions often involves identification of an enemy that stands in the way of the fulfillment of the ideology. The Cambodians wanted total social equality, the Khmer Rouge, and anybody whom they identified as standing in the way was to be eliminated. The Germans, as you know, had the notion of racial superiority and other kinds of things. So in all of these cases, there is some kind of a vision. Sometimes the two elements, the positive and the negative, coalesce. So for example, in Rwanda, Hutu power advocated Hutu power, and in order to gain Hutu power, Tutsis had to be eliminated. Now, why does this happen, that these things arise? Scapegoating, a destructive ideology, shifting identity of a group. It is, I believe, because the conditions that I described powerfully frustrate universal human needs. Under those conditions, people feel insecure, they feel diminished, they feel disconnected from other people, they feel ineffective, they cannot provide for their families. They also have their usual comprehension of reality, understanding of the world, collapse around them. It doesn't work anymore because of everything that's going on in the world. So it's response to these psychological effects that people do things that don't address the underlying conditions, but help fulfill some of these needs. By turning to a group, I feel more secure, my identity is affirmed, I feel connected to other people. By the ideology, I have a new understanding of reality and I can take action in order to support that. Could you go on to the next one? It's very important, I believe, although we are very far from it, to take action when some of these conditions already exist. What kind of action? I will give one example, and it's not a good example because the United States is such a powerful country and all that, but what Roosevelt did at the time of the Great Depression, creating a community, giving people work, it wasn't just that people had work, it was also that they were included in a community that gave them identity, that gave them connection, that they gave support, that gave them hope, is very important. In order for people to be able to do that, in poor countries, they need the help of outsiders. And there is always a combination of external and internal bystanders that is needed for early prevention. Early prevention must involve working with leaders and training leaders. And I will talk just a little bit in a moment of one kind of possible training for leaders that we did in Rwanda. I have been working in Rwanda for 9 years on reconciliation, and I won't have much time to talk about that today, but I will make the reference to that. The next one. An important issue at a time like that is persistent dialogue between groups. Now, the word persistent is extremely important. The Israelis and the Palestinians would come together for a few days somewhere, talk to each other, then go apart, and that's the end of it. But dialogue involves creating relationships. Dialogue involves in coming to understand each other and mutually progress. Yeah. So it cannot be brief, it cannot be limited, it has to be extended, it has to be ongoing, and this is crucial. Contact between groups belonging, people belonging to different groups, that's significant, that is deep. There is a great deal of research in social psychology that shows how powerful that kind of contact can be in overcoming prejudice and hostility. Being in the same setting is not enough. Talking to each other in a superficial way is not enough. Contact has to be meaningful. It has to be for shared goals. The next one, please. In addition to current conditions, the culture makes a very big difference, whether things come together in such a way that they lead to violence. In most groups, there is a history of devaluation of some group, and it is this devalued group that in difficult times becomes the scapegoat and becomes the ideological enemy. So humanizing the other at an early point, ideally, before things get really bad, is crucial. And it can be done in many ways. If one can work with leaders so that they talk in a more positive way about people, if one can work with the media and train media to get them to give a more balanced view of what happens to these people, important. Unhealed wounds, from my perspective, is a very important contributor to violence between groups. Especially past victimization in a group creates a sense of vulnerability and a perception of the world as dangerous. Not only the group that harmed you as dangerous, but the world in general as dangerous. So when there is new threat, when there is new conflict, it is much less likely that this group will engage with it in a constructive way. It is much more likely that it will strike out defensively, believing that they need to defend themselves. So healing of past wounds, not psychotherapy with individuals, societal healing, the way people engage with this. Often victimization gets built into the culture of a group, and new conditions reactivate it and extend its power as part of the culture. So engaging with this at a societal level is extremely important. Moderating authority, respect for authority is crucially important. Can we look at the next one? I just want you to glance at this because I don't have time to talk about this, but the issue of passive and active bystanders, again, is crucial. When internal bystanders and external bystanders are passive, usually people who move towards perpetration take that as an affirmation. That is, you know, I could quote to you from Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister, how he interpreted the behavior of other countries towards Jews. I could quote from other places. They take it as affirmation. So speaking out early itself could have very significant effect. There are many ways that bystanders can be extremely powerful. Now, for early action, external bystanders have to work with internal ones because external people cannot come in and really change things. They can support internal actors. They can work with internal actors, but they cannot do it themselves. Okay, the next one. Genocide does not just come about. It evolves. Individuals, members of groups, ideological movements, and so on engage in harmful action and they change. It's not possible to harm someone with the intention of harming them again and not change. You are going to devalue them more. You are going to justify your actions more. You are going to engage in all kinds of processes. So these people are progressively excluded from the moral universe. And there is what I call a reversal of morality. That is, killing these particular people because of the way they are seen as an enemy, as immoral, as bad, becomes the right thing to do for the perpetrators. So engaging with this process, with this evolution, is crucial. And that's why bystanders have power, because they can observe that this is going on. Now, this is not always continuous from one day to another. In Turkey, in 1894 to 96, a special army was created to kill about, and it killed about 200,000 Armenians. And then there was a gap in action. But the underlying psychology and attitudes and beliefs, the history of that was there. Sometimes genocide seems to prop up. Violence seems to prop up suddenly. But past violence creates a chasm between groups that can be kind of worked over. It can really be filled in. The chasm could be filled in through societal healing and other ways, but it almost never is. So the chasm is there, it's covered up, and certain conditions reopen it. And then there is this very great violence, and people say, how would it be these people were living next to each other? But if you talk to them about how they talked about each other while they went to each other's funerals and had dinners together and all that, then you will see that actually there is a continuity there. Next one, please. A major element of our work in Rwanda has focused on promoting understanding. We have done workshops with people in the community, with people working with people in the community, with journalists, as with national leaders. In fact, the tables that I showed you before, I developed in working with national leaders for working with them, because I wanted to show them how genocide originates, and I asked them to engage in an exercise. That is, to look at the policies that the government has just created and they are planning to create, and look at that table and see whether those policies contribute, make violence more likely, or contribute on the prevention side, make violence less likely. It's a very important kind of exercise because they don't just get concepts, they apply it to their own experience and what's going on in their society. But understanding the origins of genocide and also understanding the impact of genocide proved extremely powerful. We did something unusual. We did experimental research to evaluate the effects of this on community groups. And now, for a number of years now, since 2004, we have extensive radio programs to try to get to the whole population. And over 90% of Rwandans are listening to a radio drama that we have created in which there are two villages that are hostile to each other and in conflict and violence and reconciliation and all kinds of processes. That is, 100 people are working for this now in Rwanda, and it extended to Burundi and in the Congo. And I'm not going to the work that we have done in workshops has led to a reduction in trauma symptoms in people in the community who participated. Not the people we trained. We trained trainers, and they went out and worked with groups in the community. And the people, once removed from the people we trained, showed a reduction of trauma symptoms and a more positive attitude towards members of the other group, and what I call conditional forgiveness. Let me go on to the next slide. Truth and justice are very important. But the word truth is almost a meaningless word. Because whose truth? You know, a person comes to you and describes what happened to them in the genocide, and that is very true, it has great power, it is the real truth for them. But when you look at a societal process, you have to look at an overarching truth that includes all parties. And that's usually a complex truth. It was probably the least complex truth in the Nazi genocide, in that the Jews really have not done much of anything to contribute to that genocide. In Rwanda, on the one hand, it's a very simple truth, and that is the genocide was perpetrated by Hutus against Tutsis. But then if you look at the wider truth, the submission of Hutus under Tutsis before 1959 under Belgian overrule, and then also what happened in the course of the fighting and afterwards in the Congo and so on, then you, in order to create reconciliation and create an accessible truth, you have to engage with all these things, and it has to become part of the societal process. Justice is very important. The forms of justice make a difference. What kind of justice will this be? And restorative justice is a very important kind of justice that people now engage with. The creation of a shared history is absolutely difficult and very important. Early on, in 2001, in one of the leaders' workshops, we had small groups working together, and we asked one group of leaders to work on shared history. And they came back and said, extremely important, impossible right now to try to do that. So you have to work on a whole variety of ways. And sometimes the shared history involves not just establishing what happened, but also compromises, discussions between the groups as to how you can put this together in such a way that it is acceptable, that it is meaningful, that it is healing, that contributes to reconciliation. Training leaders is very important in this. And one more slide. How am I doing in time? A couple of minutes, okay. Going back to the point of understanding, and again, you know, understanding is not the only process in reconciliation. But we have found it very powerful. And one of the reasons, by the way, it's powerful is sometimes people are put into dialogue groups, leaders from two sides, people from two sides, and they immediately engage with how they were heard by the other group. And this is very difficult because perpetrators almost never acknowledge what they have done and their responsibility. In fact, that's one of the very important elements of creating reconciliation. And I believe that in order for perpetrators to acknowledge what they have done, they have to undergo some healing. Because perpetration, and not only perpetrators, but more importantly for a societal process, members of the group that the perpetrators come from, who are also impacted by what their group has done. So it's very important for them to undergo a healing, to deal with the shame, to deal with the guilt, to deal with the whole thing, to deal with their continued devaluation and blaming of their victims. Understanding can help even there. I mean, we found that in addition to the things that I mentioned, Tutsis were saying, oh, so what happened to us was not God's punishment. Oh, so this happened to other people, so are we part of humanity? This doesn't mean that we are somehow outside the realm of humanity. And my sense was that it eased something in people. There were no perpetrators in the groups we worked with, but there were Hutus. That it eased something in Hutus, and I think it prepared the ground for reconciliation. And they didn't have to engage with each other right away, because we were talking about these things and they can engage with ourselves. With us, in relation to us. At some point, you know, one of the things that we did, which is helping in the location of shared history, we applied a societal level understanding to an individual level understanding. You know, I was talking about members of the Interahamwe, the young killers, militias, who did a lot of the killing, and their situation and the difficult economic and social conditions in Rwanda, and they're being drawn into these youth groups associated with political parties that provided them with some material benefit, but give them a sense of community and a sense of identity. And then they begin to be trained into militias. A part of the training is tremendous devaluation of the Tutsis, and so how these people evolved. So what I want to finish out with is just the point that we have to create systems that will be low cost, for which there is no political will right now, to engage in early prevention, because only then will we really be able to prevent genocide. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much for your papers, for your talks. And I'm going to now invite members of the audience, if they wish, to come up to the microphone and to pose their questions to the panel. And of course, the panelists are free to ask each other questions. But before we, you know, before we actually take any questions, one thing that I wanted to say was that, as I hope is clear to you, these are people who, our panelists are people who have thought deeply and care passionately about these issues, and they have striven mightily today to keep their comments within a rather narrow time frame. And I would beg you as questioners to do the same thing. To ask whatever it is you want to ask in a fairly pointed way, and that leaves space for responses and for other people to ask questions as well. So anybody who would like to engage, please come up to the microphone.
Hi, Rebecca Saunders, Illinois State University. I have questions for you all, but I'm going to contain myself. Professor Fleming, I'm wondering, you seem to be arguing for motive as a substantial part of judgments at an early phase. And I guess I don't understand what work that does for us, either in prosecution or in prevention. And I'm wondering if you can just elaborate on that.
Let's say that in any criminal proceeding, the first stage, in any criminal proceeding, the first stage would be to specify, let's say someone is dead, and someone has been charged. Did this person have the intent? And then, of course, you would proceed to say on that basis whether or not someone has actually knowingly and intentionally committed the murder. So you would have intent. Now, and then in the, as far as motive is concerned, and the debates get very complex, but let's say that even people who are very, committed to making motive more explicit, especially in the context of hate crimes and that kind of thing, that we're seeing more and more movement towards theorizing motive as an important legal component, because classically it has always been not a legal component and maybe brought in at the end and maybe contributing to punishment. So the motive is the second stage. The intent, which is the criminal liability stage, to specify whether or not the person actually had a guilty mind and committed the guilty act, that's the first stage. So when you're talking about genocide, however, already in the definition of genocide, you have an element of a motive. It's not a matter of presumably just killing a particular group that happens to belong to a particular race or religion. What you're talking about is genocide. The very definition of genocide, if we are going to have a name for what that is, it involves not just genocidal intent on the model of criminal law generally, it also involves the genocidal motive. So in other words, you could have a number of motives, but you would nevertheless, at the very stage, it would appear, at the very beginning, as soon as somebody is charged with genocide, some person is charged with genocide, immediately you're saying, not only did you have a genocidal intent, i.e. the intent to destroy that particular group, intentionally and purposefully, you also had a genocidal motive. You wanted to deny the right of existence to that particular group based on race, religion, etc. So you've already, so in other words, already in the definition of genocide as we have it, there's already an indication that you have motive as well as intent already. And I think it was probably, within the, in 1948, within the negotiations and the problems, already a big problem of thinking in terms of genocidal intent. So bringing in genocidal motive may, people might think, complicated. And as I was writing this paper, I was thinking maybe that would complicate it more, make it even more difficult to get it in. But I think actually a way could be develop so that bringing in motive might actually, you know, expedite and help us achieve what we want to achieve, which is to get a more specific and a more successful definition of genocide. Sorry, it's a complicated question.
I have a follow-up question and then want to generate something among the panelists. Or maybe it's a suggestion. One other area of international law where there is an extensive jurisprudence is in grants for political asylum. And the motive of the persecutor is part of a decision as to whether someone is going to be granted political asylum. In other words, someone can be thrown in jail for committing a crime, but if they're thrown in jail for committing the crime, as one of our panelists has had an experience, not because they committed the crime, but because the state wants to harm them or get them out of the way because of their political activities, then that becomes persecution. So defining what persecution is might have some overlap with the relationship of defining your attempt to distinguish between motive and intent in genocide. But what I would like to ask is if either of our other panelists have comments on this issue, because having someone who comes at it from social psychology and a jurist, I think might create a little bit of interesting discussion for the rest of us to listen to. So that's my question. Dr. Staub, Juan Mendez, what are your comments on this?
The international tribunals have a separate subject matter jurisdiction on persecution that is very similar to what Susan was just describing in terms of asylum and refugee law. And of course it has a much less exacting standard than genocide. So very frequently you will see individuals charged at the ICTY and ICTR with persecution, and a lot of us wonder why not genocide. And that brings me to the more, the point that I wanted to make. I think it is possible to glean the intent, the specific intent to genocide from the facts. And in fact, the ICTR has successfully done it in a number of cases, and the ICTY in Srebrenica as well. But I don't think we should, first, because it can be gleaned from the facts, it doesn't help a lot on prevention, because until you have all the facts and you study them very carefully, it's difficult to ascertain. And that's what I meant to say, why these debates about adjudicating before preventing had been so sterile and so paralyzing to us. On the other hand, even in the case of just the judicial action itself, I see a tendency amongst us in the human rights movement to be very impatient about whether someone is charged with lesser offenses, quote unquote, like child recruitment or kidnapping of young women for sexual slavery, because that's not genocide. I mean, I think we should realize that, if we try for the prosecutors to be always going for the highest crime and for the people with the highest responsibility, and everything else seems, paltry or not conducive, we're really setting up these tribunals for failure as well. I mean, we would be pushing for prosecutions without adequate evidence and without adequate resources for them. And we're also diminishing the respect that we owe to the victims. I mean, what is it to say to a victim, well, but you were only a victim of abduction and sexual slavery, not of genocide? I mean, I think we... And I want to finish just with this sense. When in the International Commission of Inquiry for Darfur, presided by Antonio Cassese of Italy, very controversially said that there was no genocide in Darfur. I mean, but everybody forgets that they also said that every single element except for the intent was found. And Cassese said, and besides, these are certainly war crimes and crimes against humanity, and in addition, there is no hierarchy of gravity between genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. all three of them are equally serious and grave, and all three of them have to trigger an international community response on moral, legal, and political grounds.
You know, I think that these issues of definitions are very problematic. As we know, and as Juan also described, when there is mass killing going on, the international community, the UN, the Security Council is standing around waiting to see whether it can be defined as genocide and doesn't do anything along the way. I mean, this is a horrendous situation if you think about it in human terms. Because when huge numbers of people are killed, it doesn't matter to them how you call it from the outside. And so this is a real failure in the way we deal with this. But there is another piece to this, and that is, you know, motive versus intent versus what is happening. You do have to establish things from the facts that you can glean, from the institutions that are set up, from the processes, from the systems, from conversations that you can get, because perpetrators of any kind are never doing something bad. They are never doing something immoral. From their perspective, they are doing things that make sense from the standpoint of their group and the circumstances and the situation and so on. So many of them see that they are doing these things for positive underlying motives. So in fact, you have to glean it from the facts, you have to glean it from the circumstances, and you have to do it on the basis of that. But what you have to glean from the facts, I believe, is the likelihood of large-scale group violence. And that's when we need to intervene, at least through taking early preventive action.
Thank you for your talks. I'm Margot Browning from the University of Chicago. I have a question for Dr. Staub. When I try to envision the stories you're telling, which are incredibly valuable, I don't know who's participating in the sense of, are they mainly men or are any women participating? And given that women are often the victims of crimes, as the other speakers have said, it would be immensely valuable to know that as someone trying to understand the processes you're talking about. It seems as if when you speak about the Hutus or the Tutsis that perhaps you are speaking primarily of men, in which case the women as citizens of Rwanda remain invisible even in a situation where their denigration may be part of the violence, the ability to generate violence that breaks, you know, or doesn't enable civic bonds to be created. So if you could just briefly tell us what the gender reality is of your studies and interventions, that would be very valuable.
Well, most of the time, the actual perpetrators of these things are men. However, that's what you are asking. Who are the participants in terms of perpetration? Most of the time, the actual perpetrators are men, often young or youngish men. Wherever you look, you know, when there are armies, it's usually men who are drawn in, although more and more in terms of child soldiering, they take women also as sexual slaves or as helpers. But the actual violence is very often done by men. But that doesn't mean that the women are not implicated. If you look at the literature in various places, you see that there is a lot of support by women going along. Why, you know, people describe at the time of the genocide of the Armenians, when Armenians were taken away and Turkish women standing on the street and kind of jubilating, you know, making sounds of ecstasy or support at least of what was taking place. You know, if you read Machete Season about the genocide in Rwanda and the group of perpetrators, you see that most of the wives of these men were supportive, and after the day of killing, they may have joined their husbands in looting, in taking property, and so on. So unfortunately, as I said, this is a group process. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody from the group participates at all. There is usually a vanguard, and I don't just mean leaders. I mean also, you know, not everybody identifies with the group equally when there is identification shift. So there are certain people who scapegoat. There is a certain element that creates the destructive ideology. But over time, when bad conditions persist, more and more people join in. So unfortunately, it's a group process.
I'm Catherine Casey, University of Chicago. Mr. Mendez had mentioned the importance of not blaming subsequent generations for the actions of their predecessors. I was wondering if the panel could speak about the reconciliation process once it has progressed beyond the initial perpetrators.
I'm sorry, this was a question to me?
For whoever would like to take the challenge.
Could you repeat the central part of it?
I'd like to know about how the reconciliation process can take place once the main perpetrators have passed on, if there are any successful models for reconciliation beyond the actual generations of the genocide that takes place.
Any successful reconciliation process
yes.
you are looking for, yeah.
Specifically beyond the time frame of the actual action.
In other words, not visiting the sins of the fathers on the generations of the sons.
Yeah, so not way down the line. You mean that soon after the violence?
No, I mean way down the line.
Way down the line?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Thank
All
you.
Right.
Well, I think we have to be clear on what we mean by reconciliation, because especially if the second part of your question was about models, this is an area where it's very easy to fantasize, to trivialize, to erect models that can only be applied to a specific context and culture and try to transplant them elsewhere. For example, if you say the word reconciliation in Latin America, people immediately understand that you're talking about impunity. And it's wrong. They shouldn't understand it that way, certainly, but that's their experience, because the word reconciliation in Latin America has been used as a pretext for impunity, as a euphemism for impunity. And then obviously when a lot of people talk about reconciliation, they think that reconciliation is what South Africa did with respect to apartheid, and that is, and basically they envision a truth-telling exercise with the perpetrators coming forward and making, truthful confessions of their crimes and being pardoned by the society and by their victims. And I don't mean legally pardoned, but that too. Those models, as models, don't work in other contexts, or at least they don't work very well unless you're ready to adapt. And that's why we at the International Center for Transitional Justice, we always say that reconciliation is the guiding principle and the objective of every effort that we make to reckon with the past. But it's not the only effort. And it should not also be the kind of the critical norm by which we judge everything, because if you do a very serious process of truth-telling, and if you vindicate the victims by allowing them to participate in it, and you offer reparations to victims, and you prosecute some perpetrators, and then some years down the road, someone says, but there's no reconciliation because the animosities of the past are still there, then that would serve to, invalidate the whole process, and I don't think that's fair. I mean, sometimes we pursue justice for justice's sake, not for reconciliation's sake. And I think we shouldn't subordinate one principle to the other, the same with truth, et cetera. But coming more directly to questions of genocide, I think, in fact, that in some cases, reconciliation has to be a separate mechanism in addition to all of these other ones. And in fact, in my work on Darfur, I very specifically advocated for intercommunal conversations and not waiting until the end of the process, but doing it now. Because I am persuaded that the many people who are in the IDP camps, whole communities are in the IDP camps, if they were to go back to their places right now, in the conditions in which those places are to be found right now, they would have a powerful incentive to take matters into their own hands and revisit the cycle of violence against their perpetrators who are still around. And so we need to do now simultaneously the identification of the perpetrators and their prosecution and punishment. We need to offer reparations, which are contemplated in the Darfur peace agreement, but nobody takes them seriously. And Khartoum offered $30 million as a, almost as a token gesture for reparations. And we need to do reconciliation that was also contemplated in the Darfur peace agreement, and it has been completely ignored. The reconciliation in those cases has to be very specific. It has to do with letting these communities, their leaders, talk to each other free of outside interference and in truly representative ways, and about very specific things like land rights, like restitution of property, like passage rights for cattle, like grazing rights, like water rights that in Darfur is essential, and in that fashion, then reconciliation has a very specific content. It's not a misnomer. Now, does that need to happen? Continue to happen generations afterwards, like your question implies? That's very difficult to see. I mean, I unfortunately have always worked on situations in which we were doing all these things to prevent further violence from occurring right now. And so what needs to happen after we prevent what may happen now is something that was never in my radar screen, quite frankly. And I'm not sure. If we do all these things right, maybe we don't need more later on. But I suspect that you're right, that the creation of conditions for peaceful coexistence between different ethnic or other identities is not something that you do once and you've done it for good ever after.
I think, if I may, I think the questioner was also implying situations where justice was not done at the time. Yeah. And now you're one or two generations down the line and the wound is festering. What do you do?
I'll say something about that. I mean, let me just say that I totally agree with you about specificity in terms of culture, in terms of group history and group experience. But I also think that it is very important for us to establish what might be universal needs and universal processes, and then take that as a starting point, but be very loose about them and look at a particular condition and ask, is this relevant? Is this applicable? How does it have to be transformed for this particular situation? Because each of them are different. After a long time, like, let's take the former Yugoslavia. Let's take the former Yugoslavia in 1989. I think that was before it all started. There was the long history of woundedness around Kosovo in the 14th century that was embedded in the psychology of the group. Now, people sometimes act as if, oh, such a silly thing, 14th century. They forget that Yugoslavia, the Serbs, lost to Turkey at that time, and 500 years of Turkish rule followed. So it wasn't a particular event, it was a long history that created significant woundedness and engagement with that. But then there was also the killing of hundreds of thousands of Serbs by Croats with sympathetic Muslims during the Second World War. And then quiet. Tito did not allow a discussion about this. We were all communists together, we were building a future of the proletariat. And then things began to come apart economically, politically, in the culture, and so on. So what if, before this all started, there had been a national engagement with this? Well, the first thing could have been to look at, what is the culture? What do people believe? What do people hold? What are the actual attitudes now towards each other? How are these events of the past incorporated into people's sense of themselves, their individual identity, and their group identity, and their attitude toward the other? So a diagnosis, and pointing it out and bringing out to the public so that everybody can see it, and everybody can see there is a problem here, there is an issue here, this must be addressed. Then the question, how do you address it? How do you engage in a dialogue where people assume responsibility? That is so important, assume responsibility, showing empathy for
the victims of your actions. And if somehow it's possible to create a regret. And then there is also the question of reparation at a later time. But what form? That's a very sensitive issue always. People say that groups avoid these things because they are afraid that they will be made to engage in reparation. So one has to be very careful about that. But another part of this is, I think, a national conversation, dialogue between leaders in churches, community members, and so on, not only about the past, but envisioning a future. One of the problems with commemorations, which are healing, which can be healing and very valuable, is when they focus on the hurts and woundedness of the past and don't include a vision of where this could be and how we can live together peacefully. That has to be a very important part of the conversation. There is a lot more, but...
Professor Fleming, did you want to comment or...?
No,
I'd like to come back to the issue of motives, if we may. Could you, Dr. Fleming, specify what you perceive as the key motives in Darfur? And I'm talking specifically in regard to the GOS, the government of Sudan, and the Janjaweed. And could you also address what is the evidence that you use to ascertain those motives?
Well, the... let's say with the evidence, presumably, would go along a similar line that you would address intent. If you're talking about genocidal intent, for example, you're going to make reference to expressions that a person or the perpetrator made, explicit, maybe explicit, the actions as well. So similarly for motives, it's complex. It's complex, and people, I think that the motives are more complex than intent. It's just, even with Lemkin, it just didn't, apparently, as far as we know, he didn't really care about the particular motives, genocide, but already within his definition of genocide, the motives are already implied, you see? So, in other words, the definition of genocide that we have, even as it stands in the UN Convention, still implies motive, that you would have to have a genocidal motive. Now, Kieran is my good friend, by the way. I was criticizing him, but he is a good friend. But he pays very careful attention to the detail of the convention. And he's correct insofar as, you know, in a narrow, strict reading, which always what will happen in a, you know, legal proceeding, the definition itself allows for the incorporation of any possible motive. In other words, the perpetrator could just merely accept, maybe even not go that far, accept that genocide could result from this. In other words, it could be conquest, it could be, and of course he would like to have political in there, but political is not in there in the definition. So he wants to keep that definition as so sacrosanct, and he can go back and he can talk about genocides in the past, all kinds, in other words, any kind of mass murder. I mean, presumably, I wouldn't want to demonstrate it here now, but you could get before a class of students and the mass murders, the genocides are going on all the time. In other words, it becomes a nullification of the need for a new name. So, I mean, and I would just like to say, in reaction to Professor Staub, sorry about this, but it does, impinge on this, is that when we're talking about definitions, and I know you said that definition, you know, is problematic, and that somehow the implication was, and I don't know if I gathered this from the first question, but it might have been an implication, that somehow we have to wait around until we get a definition before we can do anything about the violence that's taking place. But that's not the implication at all. We are doing both at the same time. We're defining it, thinking about it, writing scholarship is being conducted on it. We're preventing it in the field. We have all kinds. In other words, there are a lot of different actions going on. But one does not mean to say, when one focuses on the definition, that therefore everything has to stop, because violent acts are going on. And you see?
I beg your pardon, but we're really fresh out of time. In fact, we've gone over. If I could ask us to continue this conversation at a more personal level.